Welcome to this podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. My name is Sally Higginbottom, and today I am interviewing Dr. Gail Allsop, Clinical Policy Lead at the RCGP and leading on long COVID, a GP in Derbyshire, and also a GP in the long COVID clinic in Derbyshire. Welcome, Gail.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we're going to start right at the beginning. What is long COVID? Is that even the right name for it?
Well, this is interesting. So long COVID is a patient-derived term, and we have to thank the people who have been suffering or living with long COVID for bringing this to the attention of the healthcare profession. In December last year, NICE Sign and the RCGP came together to write the first national guideline for the long-term effects of COVID-19. And within that guideline, there is a definition of what this means. And what we discovered is long COVID is used in all sorts of different ways by different groups, different patient groups, different researchers. So what the team decided to do at NICE is to actually come up with a definition, and the working definition that the guideline is based on is if you have symptoms between 0 and 4 weeks, it's considered acute COVID, because we expect most people will have recovered from an acute viral infection by 4 weeks. If you then have symptoms that last longer than 12 weeks, it's called post-COVID syndrome. Now, in between times, that 4 to 12 weeks is really the period where we're trying to rule out other causes for symptoms, perhaps do some investigations. And this is just termed ongoing symptomatic COVID-19. So really, long COVID is the right term to use with patients, but just as we use skin infections with patients, yet we code cellulitis, it's the same with this condition. We'll talk about long COVID, but code post-COVID syndrome.
So who does it affect and how common is it?
This depends on what studies you look at. And at the moment, we are really still trying to get to the bottom of how many people are affected by this condition. The Office for National Statistics is doing a self-reported questionnaire that reports back every month. And the latest figures that were presented in July this year show that actually there's been a slight reduction in the number of people suffering from symptoms lasting 4 weeks or longer, what we would call long COVID, down from 1 million in June to about 960,000 now. And we would expect this, because what that's showing is the effect really of the first and the second wave of patients coming through. For patients suffering from symptoms for longer than 12 weeks, post-COVID syndrome, again, there's been a slight reduction in the last month from around 870,000 down to 850,000. But what we are now seeing is people with symptoms lasting more than a year. So those coming out of that first wave of COVID, that actually we're seeing a gradual increase month on month. So that's now gone up to 385,000 people. In terms of who's affected, well, this condition can affect anybody. And I think that's really, really important. When we look at lots of the studies, it says women are more commonly affected, and particularly between the ages of 35 and 69 is the sort of typical age that people are getting this from those studies. But actually, this can affect anybody at all. So I've seen people in my own post-COVID clinic from the ages of 9 to 99. We've got people in care homes who are suffering from ongoing effects of COVID-19 or post-COVID syndrome. And it doesn't matter what your gender is. It does affect men as well as women. Something like a 2-to-1 ratio. We think women are more commonly affected, but men definitely are affected. And it doesn't matter what your ethnic group is. This disease really can affect anyone. And it doesn't matter what your original disease was like. It doesn't matter what your original infection was like. So of course we have people who are in hospital in intensive care who are discharged and have the natural recovery that you would expect from someone with organ failure or organ damage coming out of intensive care, and we see that in the community all the time. But what we've never seen before really is the scale of ongoing symptoms from people with very mild infections in the initial phase of illness, and those people are not recovering quite in the way that we would expect them to.
Thank you. And it's a lot of people now, isn't it? So what are the common symptoms that you see?
So the most common symptoms that most of us are aware of are fatigue and breathlessness. And this is one phenotype, really, of the condition that we see. And the fatigue is more than just being tired. The fatigue is people describing themselves as walking through treacle. They physically don't feel that they can move their limbs, and they get pain associated with their limbs, almost as though you've got high lactic acid in your muscles, that sort of muscle pain after you've been running for a long time. And the shortness of breath in some people has underlying pathology. But actually what we're seeing in the vast majority, particularly of those who weren't admitted to hospital, is actually it's something called disordered breathing. But on top of those common symptoms, this is a disease that is multi-system. It can affect anything. And those symptoms tend to change over time as well, and they can wax and wane and come and go. So it really can affect anywhere from your heart. We see lots of palpitations, particularly when people are standing up or going into the shower. And we think this is related to a postural tachycardia type syndrome or a dysautonomia. People with chest pain, some of which might be myocarditis or pericarditis, we need to make sure we rule out the red flags. But actually, the vast majority has not been proven to be myocarditis. Cognitive changes are really common. This thing called brain fog, and the way people describe that to you is they're talking absolutely fine, and then it's almost like the words are taken away, that they can't find the word that they want to use. And we think this is because of a cognitive fatigue as well as a physical fatigue. But headaches, skin rashes, muscle, joint pain, neurological problems, paresthesia, diarrhea, the list goes on and on. It really can affect any system at all.
And do we have any idea why the symptoms seem to come and go so much?
That's one of the million-dollar questions, really. And there's so much research at the moment being put into this condition. I would hope we'll have huge numbers of answers over the coming months and certainly over the next year. A lot of the fatigue symptoms seem to be that people are pushing themselves too much and then they're getting the rebound fatigue. So this sort of boom and bust approach. And that also seems to fit with the cognitive fatigue that people are getting as well. So if they do too much and they push themselves too much on one day, then actually the next day they tend to be falling back and into bed, or their fatigue worsens. And there's a lot of that we're seeing. But in terms of why symptoms are coming and going, that one day you might be fine and then 2 weeks later you'll get a skin rash and then a couple of weeks later you'll get a headache, we just don't know yet.
So how easy is it to diagnose, and what investigations should we be doing in primary care?
So the first thing to do is make sure we see the patients, believe our patients, talk to them and use shared decision making to make sure that we are doing what's right for them as well as what's right for us as clinicians. And don't underestimate the fear that these patients hold when they come to see you. These are young and fit, normally, people whose lives have changed almost overnight. And the fear that this is never going to get better, or the loss of normality from them. So don't underestimate how much support and empathy that they need in those initial consultations. We've got to take a complete history. So we're going back to our medical school days where we're doing all of our systems within our history and really taking time. And if that means you've got to bring them back over two or three appointments, then so be it, building that rapport with these patients to really work out what's going on with them. Depending on their symptoms will then depend on what examination you do. And certainly if they're short of breath, I would advocate seeing them face to face, listening to their chest, checking their oxygen saturations. If someone is just describing anxiety or psychological effects relating to their long COVID, then you might not need to see them face to face. You may be able to do all that by remote care. Once your history is complete, then of course we need to think about those investigations. And again, that depends on what they're presenting with. If they're still short of breath, you might need to think about reasons for that. So could it be heart failure? Do you need to do a BNP depending on their age? If they're young and female, could they be pregnant? Is that why they're short of breath? Is it a thyroid disorder issue if they've got hypothyroidism? So depending on what the presentation is will depend on the investigations that you do. Now, some post-COVID clinics are just asking for blanket blood tests, and I would argue that's probably not the right approach and feels like a very secondary care approach. I think we all know in primary care that actually we assume people are well until they prove otherwise. Whereas in secondary care, they assume everybody's ill and they want all the tests to be completed. So I think follow your patient, look at what's wrong with them, examine them, do what we do really well as GPs, that biopsychosocial approach to care, but making sure we really look out for those red flags depending on what the symptoms are that they present with.
And you mentioned a biopsychosocial approach, and different post-COVID clinics have been set up by different people and with different emphases. So how does your clinic work, and how would other clinics work in terms of their focus?
So yeah, you're absolutely right. The post-COVID clinics that have been commissioned across England, of course, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland don't have any at the moment, but certainly across England, those clinics have been commissioned, and each system has set them up differently. So there are some that are based in secondary care with respiratory physicians. There are some that are based in secondary care that are led by a physiotherapist, some by psychologists. The clinic that I work in, I think, has a great model because it's run by GPs. So it's a community clinic. And GPs are paid by the session to actually come and work in this clinic. So not only are we upskilling the GPs within the community to take things back to their own practice, but actually we are used to seeing people from cradle to grave. And this disease very much fits with what we've always done as general practitioners: undifferentiated presentation, multi-system illness, holding on to risk, because there's a huge amount we don't know about this, actually using the consultation to help the patient, and that relationship-based care that is really, really important, that doctor as the drug type approach, making sure that we've got that empathetic approach is really, really important. So we have an hour with a GP within the clinic, and then once we've completely assessed them from a biopsychosocial perspective, we then link into what we call our virtual MDTs. And we have two of them. One of them is medically based. So if we need high level investigations, MRI scans of heads, et cetera, we can just speak to our secondary care colleagues. We present the case, they help us with treatment, but also they can order those really intense investigations if they're needed. Equally, we then also have a therapy MDT. And I have to say, I have learned more from sitting in on that therapy MDT than I think I have done in the last 10 years of my medical career. It's incredible to sit with such rich practitioners who know so much about so many things that we have never thought of as a GP. So from dietitians, from health psychology, we've got physios, we've got, you name it, the therapist is there. And within these therapy MDTs, once the patient is determined as being fit for rehabilitation, they then help us as to what is the best approach. And the way that the clinics are running across England, and certainly other places as well, even outside England, is we don't have enough rehab teams to manage this condition. We just don't, with the volume of patients coming through. So they're digitally enabling some of the resources. So there are online classes. There are digital apps that people are using to actually help with that rehabilitation and recovery. Or there are alternative providers. We're working with some of our gyms locally who have upskilled their PT instructors to work alongside physiotherapists to actually support them through their rehabilitation. So this really is changing the way we look at rehabilitation, and hopefully for the better, because hopefully we can then extrapolate this to all of our long-term conditions rather than just thinking about this condition.
It's been interesting seeing some of our letters back from my local clinic, including some plans for double histamine blockade, which seems to be something I hadn't come across in other disorders. Are we prescribing in that sort of situation?
So what's really important to understand at the moment is anything that's prescribed in long COVID is done as best guess. And I say that knowing a lot of people in clinics, and certainly some of the academics who are trialing things. Now, we are hoping there will be some randomized controlled trials in the not too distant future on therapeutics for long COVID. But at the moment, we don't know if any of them work. So yes, if somebody has a very bad rash, of course, we're going to think about antihistamines. And we do this anyway. We double up our antihistamine doses. If someone's got terrible diarrhea or gastrointestinal effects, we might think about something like famotidine. Of course, we can't prescribe ranitidine, but we would do that anyway. So all we're doing is treating people's symptoms. Some of the things that do worry me that I've seen from some of the post-COVID clinics is that they're just trialing things like aspirin or rivaroxaban that I've heard anecdotally. And I think it's really important that we don't do that until we've got randomized controlled trial evidence, because of course all these drugs have side effects. But I think if we're treating symptoms and that symptomatic treatment works, why, of course, we're going to continue it.
And thinking about other support we offer to our patients, what are we doing about work or family with these patients?
So I think this is really important, because the cohort of patients that are most commonly affected, as I've said, is this younger cohort. So these are parents, sisters, brothers at a young age, people of a working age. And of course, this disease is impacting not only them as a person, but their families, their children, their siblings, their partners, as well as their work colleagues. So there's a number of things. I think one of the things to flag if you're in England is the post-COVID clinics are being encouraged to provide the Med3 certificates for these patients. So if your clinic isn't, that might be something you could write to them just to say it is covered in the commissioning guide. In terms from a general practice point of view, if you're seeing somebody with you, it's exactly the same as any other condition. Again, this is what we do all the time. We look at our patients, we talk to them, we ask them what they can do, whether they think they can go back to work. Sometimes we end up writing to employers to try and explore things with them, but we always recommend they go to their occupational health teams at work. So again, really, really important that we just continue doing what we've always done and not treat this in any different way, but just realizing there are more patients and they may need more intensive care from us than perhaps some of our older patients with long-term conditions do, because they've grown used to their long-term conditions. Those people who had a heart attack and now have heart failure 5 years down the line. Remember, these are younger people who were usually very fit before they became unwell with COVID and very suddenly their life has changed. So actually that support is often much more intense than perhaps we've been used to giving before.
When you think about communicating with patients, do you have any good ways of explaining what might be going on? I know it's early days.
So there's huge numbers of theories that are out there, but we haven't proven anything. And I think, again, that's really important, being honest with our patients, that we are all learning together. Certainly in the early phases, my first patient with long COVID, I treated back in May last year. She was at an early stage admitted with COVID. And working with her over the year as more and more evidence has come out, one of the things she reflects back to me is how she appreciates how honest I was, that I didn't know, but that I would stand by her while we all found out together. And I think that's really important, reassuring people that you're there, reassuring people they can contact you, reassuring people that your team can help. But actually, there is no miracle cure at the moment, and recovery from anything takes time. And if we can recover and have hope of recovery, but actually provide support while people recover, then I would hope that this will be much more beneficial for patients rather than just simply pretending we know the answer to something that actually we don't at the moment.
What about children?
So we are seeing evidence that there are a small number of children, and I do mean a small number of children, who have long-term effects of COVID-19. Now, of course, we have a small cohort who had the multi-inflammatory syndrome, the PIMS, following on from COVID. And this is an absolute red flag that we need to think about. If we have a child who's had COVID that comes to see us 4 or 5 weeks later and they've got a rash or they're still unwell, it's really important to think, is this a child that needs admitting for bloods? Once we've got past that this is not something that needs an urgent referral, always important to ask yourself what else is going on in that child's life. So is this long COVID, or is this the effect of the lockdown? Have there been deaths in their family? Is there something going on at school? All the usual questions that again, we would ask a child who's presenting with symptoms to us. Now, NHS England is beginning to set up a cohort of, I think, 15 clinics across England in our post-COVID clinic, because we're GPs, we see children as well. But they're in much fewer numbers than actually the adult population that are suffering from this are.
A thing of great concern to a lot of people at the moment, isn't it? Whether there's going to be an increase in this group. Is there any evidence as to whether certain variants are more likely to cause long-term symptoms after COVID?
So at the moment, there isn't. Now, we don't yet know what's going to happen with this wave. Of course, we've got a new variant, the Delta wave, that is hitting us at the moment with huge numbers. And of course, there's a huge fear that in 3 months' time, because this is a much younger cohort that are suffering with the disease at the moment, that will have huge numbers of long COVID coming through. And actually, whilst that is a real worry, we don't know whether that's going to happen. You know, it could be by some miracle that actually this variant doesn't cause long COVID, or it could be that we've got much better treatment, or it could be that the vaccines that most people have had now will protect from long COVID, but we just don't know. And I think that's one of the really scary things about this condition, is that we don't know so much. It's certainly the first time in my career that we've got more questions than answers about something.
Yeah, absolutely. There is this online package, Your COVID Recovery, that the NHS have put together. Can we refer to that package?
So Your COVID Recovery, there are two parts to it. Now, the first part is an open website, and I would say this is a brilliant resource for anybody within primary care, not only for you to learn about the long-term effects, but also to signpost your patients to. And it surprises me how few patients have seen this by the time they come to our post-COVID clinic. It has lots and lots of information on there, from relating to people who've been in hospital and discharged, about what to expect for support for families in those situations, but also information on fatigue, information on getting back to work, getting back to your normal life, taste disturbances, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of information there that you can use to upskill yourself, but also you can refer your patients to. There's then a second part to Your COVID Recovery, and really this needs a rehabilitation expert to refer patients into. So whilst lots of GPs showed interest in this, because it requires training, it requires registering with the Your COVID Recovery people, and it also requires ongoing supervision of people whilst they are undergoing their remote digital rehabilitation. Actually, the recommendation now is that this should come via either a physio or an allied healthcare professional who's experienced in rehabilitation. So the vast majority of people using this will be going through the the post-COVID clinics or a community rehab clinic before they are sent to it. But it could be you've got an innovative practice with, you know, your own first contact physiotherapist and you want to sign up to it, but don't underestimate the work that's involved. There are other digital resources that again require referral via a rehab professional. One is called Living with COVID Recovery. And again, many of the clinics are using that to sign their patients up to.
It sounds like a great resource and a way of scaling the care that's going to be needed for people. So if someone who has long COVID finds their symptoms eventually resolve, but they have some sort of end organ damage, whether that's a myocarditis or something else, do they remain coded as having a post-COVID-19 syndrome indefinitely?
Yeah, this is a really good question, isn't it, about coding generally. So I think the first thing to highlight is the codes are on the system for post-COVID syndrome and for the ongoing symptomatic COVID-19. And it's really important we use coding, because if we don't, we're never going to truly know how many people have this condition. And therefore, we won't get the resources that we need in primary care, but also the system needs from a rehabilitation point of view. There is a new code now that has been launched, and you should be able to search for these under long COVID now. There is no code for long COVID because it's not the medical term, it's the patient term. So if you search for either post-COVID syndrome or you search for long COVID, you should see these codes come up. Now, if somebody's all of their symptoms have completely resolved and they have no end organ damage, you can use the post-COVID-19 syndrome resolved code. If people have end organ damage because of their COVID infection, then at the moment, the recommendation is to keep that post-COVID-19 syndrome code in place, partly again, because we need to know about total numbers. We need to know so we can give those resources to the right place, but also so that the patient is still recognised as having complications of COVID until we actually know what the very long-term outcome of this condition is.
And very pertinent to GPs. Is post-COVID syndrome likely to be listed as an occupational disease? Will it have an impact on us, both in terms of our own care and our own teams and requests for letters and the like?
Another great question. And this is something that there are some MPs who are proactively pushing for this, and the BMA is heavily involved in looking at the impact on healthcare workers. And I think it's really important just to go back to those ONS figures that show health and social care workers are more likely to have long COVID, because of course we were more exposed in the early phase of the pandemic. What we also have is a bit of a discrepancy at the moment in our sick leave, in that secondary care, if in secondary care you have a sick note that says you've got long COVID, your sick pay continues at the full rate, and this has been supported by the government. Unfortunately, in primary care, that's not the case. And we have seen evidence of some partners having to give up their partnership, some salaried GPs having to walk away after 6 months of being ill because their sick pay goes down, some locums not being able to afford to live the way that they lived before because, of course, they can't get out to work. So I think there is a discrepancy. Will it become an occupational health disease? I think that's a really difficult question, because if the government say yes, how do we prove that people caught it at work? Is a lot of the questions that are coming back. Should it be? I would argue it probably should for those of us that were exposed and caught it at work, absolutely, particularly if that impact is then going to impact on you, yourself and your work and the rest of your career and the team that you're working with.
Lots of questions for the future as well. Is there any last thing you'd like to tell all the GPs and others working in primary care who'll be listening?
I think for me is don't listen to the negative press that we are continually getting as GPs on this subject. We're fighting really hard at the Royal College to make sure that our reputation in this sphere and in lots of other spheres is upheld, despite the fact that some of our partners within the system are trying to really look upon us as sometimes as the bad guy in this story. Actually, we've put so much resource and so much time into developing not only resources, we've got an e-learning that's up there. We've got a webinar that you can go to Webinar Rewind and have a little look. We're doing obviously this podcast today, and we're right at the centre of trying to make sure that general practice has the resources it needs to look after this. So please stay positive about this condition and believe your patients, but look for the fear and don't underestimate how frightened they are.
That's brilliant. Thanks very much for your time, Gail. And thank you for listening to this podcast from the RCGP.